when the tape ended, you were talking about what President Hanna's reaction to...
To Rufus calling him about this guy Schiff. So Hanna says to him, don't you have anything better to do than try to run the university? What Rufus should have said was no. But it didn't occur to him. He said yes. But anyway, Hanna didn't... I don't think he... Yeah, he did know about the Schiff case because they had had this group discussion. But anyway, he said, we had good reasons to dismiss him. And if he, you tell him if he wants to know why he's been dismissed or suspended, he certainly ought to know. So then the two of us went to see the vice president for student affairs, a guy named John Fusak, who's a nice guy, but he had some kind of back problem. And he was so uncomfortable when we tried to grill him to find out why this guy Schiff had been denied those class cards. He was squirming and so on. I began to think, God, if we don't let up on this guy, he's going to have a heart attack right here in his office.
Yeah. Now, you said we, that was Bob Rupus?
Well, Bob Rupus. Okay. And Rupus was a kind of a bulldog. See, I don't think of myself that way. I'm more moderate. I'm stubborn and persistent, and I can have good staying power. But I don't threaten people, apparently. Sometimes I wonder why the hell I don't when I want to. Anyway, Fusak, if I remember correctly, he blurted out some of the reasons why this had happened to Schiff. And one of them was this incident of shoving these flyers under students' doors in the dorm and whatnot. He said he broke the rules. He knew what the rules were. He deliberately violated them. And then I think there's something about they're a disruptive force on the campus. That had to do with holding meetings, and they'd have a bullhorn. But the place where they held the meetings was that grassy area with the museum in one place, the student union building in another, and the music school, and then Morrill Hall. It's quite a large area, and that rock that's outside here across the street from Bessie Hall.
Used to be up there,
and that was a meeting place, kind of a Hyde Park. Well, they were so far away from the library or any classrooms, I don't see how, even with a bullhorn, they could possibly have disrupted what was termed the normal processes of the university, which I assume meant classes. But anyway, that came out of our meeting with the Fusak. So Rupus and I were both active. We were both on the ACLU board. So we went to ACLU and said, we think the ACLU ought to support this guy Schiff, and maybe we could negotiate this with President Hanna, get him back in school. So the board agreed to do that, and then we decided that given the icon status of President Hanna, and I think of a little touchiness on his part about anybody challenging him, we would send a committee to meet with him, but it wouldn't include anybody from the faculty. So we got the general counsel of the ACLU for the state of Michigan to come from Detroit, and another person from Detroit, and I think we got George Griffiths, who might have been mayor of East Lansing at that time, he either was or became mayor. So this committee consisted of people outside the campus, and they met with Hanna and I think the provost and whatnot, and explained to the president that it appeared to us and the ACLU that Schiff had been denied readmission in violation of his First Amendment rights. And so the conclusion was the university ought to let him back in. Well, Hanna refused to budge. So they said, you force us to go to court if you take that position. Well, he said, that's your decision. You do what you have to do. So ACLU filed a suit in federal court. At that time it was over in Grand Rapids. And by chance, we got the one judge on that court. You know how a district court might have several judges assigned to it? I think he was the one judge who might have shown a little sympathy for the Schiff matter. And he was the guy who took the case. So we went, a whole bunch of us piled into cars and went over to observe the court. And an ACLU lawyer from Lansing, a guy named Ken Lang, L-A-I-N-G, he's still around, by the way, And he represented, Lang represented Hildebrand in these two court cases I talked about. Well, he took the case on a pro bono basis. So, there were half a dozen of us. President Hanna was over there, the Vice President for Student Affairs, a couple of other administrators were there in the courtroom.
Was Gordon Sabine there?
I wouldn't have known Sabine if I he came up and smacked me in the face with a dead salmon. I used to revile him, you know. I'd say Gordon Sabine as if I were pronouncing some evil word or something. Well, see, I know how I would link it up. He was in charge of special projects. Mm-hmm. See, and that has a kind of an unsavory sound to it, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Especially when you're talking about students being arbitrarily mistreated. Mm-hmm. One of his special projects I tried to convey was weed out dissenters and protesters. So anyway, Judge Fox, after he listened to all this, said, one of the things that came up that was sort of struck me as ridiculous at that time was the university attorney was a guy named Lee Carr. We used to call him Judge. I think he might have been a judge, or his old man might have been a judge. He was a pretty nice guy, but he represented the university. He would defend the university because that was his job, regardless of how he might have felt about it. I asked him one time, when the university gets in all these scrapes and we take them to court, they're hauled into court, do they consult with you before they embark on these actions? He said, oh no, he says, they do it, and then they call me in to save them. Anyway, he cited several cases going back to the 1920s or so, which had been cited by the Michigan Supreme Court, which was considered in legal circles until the 50s as one of the worst Supreme Courts in the nation. And one case, and these cases, which were upheld by the Michigan Supreme Court, involved actions taken by the university against a student of the most outrageously arbitrary manner. Here's an example. A woman student back in the early 20s was observed walking across the campus smoking a cigarette. She was kicked out for that, and that was upheld by the Michigan Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. The university has virtually unlimited authority to do any damn thing.
And that was established, that in loco parentis principle. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he cited these cases, and the attorney for the ACLU cited four or five cases that had been decided just a few years earlier in southern federal courts in which black students would be arrested for sitting at a lunch counter. Mm-hmm. Etc. Or they'd be kicked out of school for sitting at a lunch counter and causing a problem for the, the store. Mm-hmm. And they had, whatever group, probably NAACP, I suppose, in those cases, had taken those cases into federal court, which had ruled that these were unlawful deprivations of rights students have in the Constitution. And so Judge Fox listened to those, and then he told the authorities there, he said, you go back. He said, this court is not going to decide who can be admitted or who can't be admitted at Michigan State. That's for you folks to decide. But you can't just treat somebody as if that person had no rights in the process of deciding admission or not. So you go back to Michigan State, East Lansing, and you put together a representative committee. In those days, you didn't say faculty and student, just said student, or faculty. Give this young man a hearing. Tell him what the charges are against him. Give him a hearing before that committee. Make sure all the requirements of due process are met. And he says to Carr, if you don't know what due process is all about, read such and such a case, citing a couple of these cases decided in the South, which I thought was terribly embarrassing, but nobody else seemed to think so. So we all came back to the campus, and we had a standing committee of the faculty at that time. It was called the Faculty Committee on Student Affairs, something like that. And they scheduled a hearing. Oh, first they told Schiff why he had been denied readmission. And, one charge was violating the rule against distributing advertising material, as if announcement of a meeting is to protest in local parentheses advertising material. That was one charge. And there were about 8 or 9 charges. I can't remember all of them. But one of them was he publicly insulted a member of the faculty. Well, that turned out to be a situation in which Schiff was at an NAACP meeting, and they were discussing something that was they didn't like. I know what they were discussing. They were discussing the inability of black students to rent a room in East Lansing. Mm-hmm. So they had asked the mayor of East Lansing, who was a guy named Gordon Thomas, who was on the faculty, mayor not being a full-time job, you know. Mm-hmm. So here's Mayor Thomas, in his capacity as mayor, not as his capacity as professor of history or whatever he was in. He came to explain to this group why the city didn't adopt an open housing ordinance. So Schiff, in the middle of all this, jumped up and he says, "You're a liar." And Thomas said, "Well, if you're going to call me a liar, I'm leaving." So Ernest Green, I told you about him last time, who was the chairman of this group, pleaded with Mayor Thomas to stay. So he did, and they continued on. They didn't resolve that issue, but he stayed. So that was you insulted a member of the faculty. See, well, he didn't insult a member of the faculty, really. He insulted a mayor, who's fair game, right? Mm-hmm. So that was the quality of the charges. So this committee met, and Adams and I went over to testify in support of Schiff and Repas. And Lanzalotti, our chairman, was over there to support the administration. And when we came in, it was held over in the Kellogg Center. And in those days, they had something called the Heritage Room, about the size of this one. And I think there were about 10 or 12 faculty members on this committee on student affairs or whatever it was. So as we went down the hallway, we noticed there were two rooms, one on each side of the hallway. And the one room was reserved there for the people who were on the Schiff side of this argument, and the other for people supporting the administration. So we figured, Walter and I figured, we'll be in the room for the Schiff side. Well, that was just like a classroom, nothing in there except chairs. We went over to the other side, and the administration had laid on a supply of refreshments and coffee and tea.
So you didn't have any of that?
So we went pigged out on that stuff, university expense. And then we went back and told the Schiff supporters, and some of them were students, and scruffy looking, like grungy students now, you know. But only they had beards and long hair, just the kind of people the administration was terrified of. We said, "Hey, they got a bunch of goodies over there. Go on over there." So they went over there. And the pro-administration people didn't have the nerve to kick them out, so they partook of that. Well, anyway, we crashed the party. And the hostility, we went in one at a time. We were sequestered and went in one at a time. So I'm sitting there. I felt like Joan of Arc and her inquisitors or something, and I never felt such a hostile environment as I did there. And these are my colleagues, you know, from all around the campus. Well, they unanimously ruled that the administration was entirely justified in denying Schiff readmission. So then what to do? We looked up the membership of this committee, and we found out that this was not a representative committee. They had all been appointed by deans. Who would want to sit on a committee like that in local parentis days and pass judgment on whether somebody should be suspended indefinitely for coming in late or something? Mm-hmm. So these are all stooges for the administration. You know, a sensible person would have refused to serve on a committee like that. That's my judgment. Mm-hmm. So they considered Walter and me traitors. And it just felt, and Just as I started to testify, the lights went out.
Oh, no.
Which I thought was perfectly fitting. They came back on and we resumed. Well, anyway, they ruled unanimously the administration was right to do what it did. So then what to do? We decided we'd go back to the court and contend that the university had not done what it told to do, which was put together a representative committee of the faculty and hear this, give Schiff a chance to defend himself. So now, how are you going to get back in court? The ACLU was willing to send a lawyer back in there, but then, well, then we held a meeting. Adams happened to be the chairman of the local branch of AAUP at that time. This was 65. So he decided we'll call a meeting. The only item on the agenda will be the Schiff case. And he said to me, your job, because I'd been following this, you know, advising Schiff right along, and talking with the ACLU people and the lawyer who represented, he said, you give a talk to this group and explain to them what this is all about. So I said, okay. So, oh, before this meeting could be held, President Hanna called a meeting of the Academic Senate, the only item on the agenda of which was the Schiff case. So I figured I've got to be there for that. I usually didn't go to the Senate meetings, but I went and I sat right shows you what a dumb cluck I can be at times. I sat right in the front row with the clipboard, and Hanna's describing the events involved in this case, and I'm writing him down. And one of the things he said was that the university had, after this first court appearance and subsequent to this committee ruling supporting the administration, he said, we decided to readmit Paul Schiff. And he, instead of accepting that, he took us back into court. And he said, that behavior is outrageous, and I don't think we'll readmit him, something like that. And I said to myself, I don't think that's right. If you're going to attack the king, you know, it's commonplace to say you don't attack the king, you attack his advisors. Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately for me, Hanna had been off the campus when all this happened. So it was his advisors who gave him bum advice. So how was I going to prove that he was wrong about that? Because that sounded like a dirty trick on Schiff's part. Mm-hmm. You know, you're told you're going to be readmitted, and then you get a lot of publicity, you go back into court, this kind of thing. So I decided to prepare a chronology. I finally ran to, I think, 3 pages, something like that. And I called the clerk of the court over in Grand Rapids, and I said, could you tell me when Ken Lang filed this action to get back into court and argue that this committee on the campus was not the committee the judge had expected. So he checked, and he said it was something like 2 o'clock or something in the afternoon. I said, could you send me a piece of paper with a stamp on it, you know, received at this time? So he did. Well, what had actually happened was the administration was not negotiating with the ACLU or Schiff to let him back in, but the clerk of the court, as a courtesy to a public institution, had called the university when this filing came in at 2 in the afternoon, saying we want to have another hearing before Judge Fox, in response to which, at 5 o'clock, some minion of the administration went over to Schiff's rooming house to tell him that the university was willing to consider readmitting him. So you see, Hanna had it just upside down, right? Mm-hmm. So that was part of my chronology. But I also found out in the process of putting together this chronology that Schiff, somehow, somebody in the econ department, must have been the chairman, changed something on his, what do you call this document that contains a student's grade.
The transcript.
The transcript. Mm-hmm. Had made some changes on the transcript. Now, that transcript is a secret document.
Yeah,
you know,
inviolate.
You're not supposed to change anything on there. Or if you do, if you transfer somebody from academic probation back onto off probation, you show both on and off and the dates and that kind of thing. Well, it wasn't done that way. There was this change was made. And I think the change gave the impression that he was unacceptable as a grad student at that point. I'm not certain, but it was negative anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's in my chronology. So I gave this talk. I timed the talk so it would be 20 minutes. And we called up WKR. They showed up. It was in the Union Building. They had a mic and a long pole, you know. And at the beginning of the meeting, Adams pointed out to the people, about 200 people, they're probably the biggest meeting we ever had before or since of the AAUP. He told everybody, WKR's here, they're recording the meeting. If you don't want to be taped, then let me know and you won't be taped. Or let the guy with the pole know that. Well, one or two people said, that's a bad idea. I think they were fearful of retaliation or something. But nobody failed to respond when the guy stuck the mic in front of them. Mm-hmm. So I gave my little pitch there, and I handed out copies of this chronology. And I said, now if you will look on page one, you'll see this and that. And pointed out Hannah had this chronology upside down and made Schiff look bad when in fact made the university look bad when you got it straightened out. I was really proud of that. And some people told Adams later, you know, that LaRue, he's really scholarly.
You don't know what Walter said about that?
I think he laughed. But anyway, it was a pretty exciting meeting. People were jumping up and down. And the thing that got him more than anything else was tampering with his transcript. And as I remember it, the change was not all that damaging to him, mm-hmm. but it was tampering with the transcript. Mm-hmm. And even one of the people there who decided not to vote for some reason, I think he had ambitions to go up the ladder in administration, and so he didn't vote. Even he was very perturbed when he heard about this changing the transcript. Well, anyway, this meeting led to a motion under which the AUP chapter filed an amicus brief in federal court. So Adams and a guy named Adrian Jaffe, who was in English, and I were given the assignment of writing the amicus brief. We did it. We had a lot of fun writing it. I was called away to work on my Christmas tree or something while they were working on the, and both these guys were Jews. So they never let me forget that, you know.
You were celebrating Christmas.
Yeah. Anyway, I wasn't contributing much to writing the brief. Mm-hmm. Jaffe was a very clever writer, and Adams was a clever writer and had a lot of good ideas and whatnot. And then we discovered you can't, see, you or I as non-lawyers can't just decide to file an amicus brief. We have to get a lawyer to file it for us. Mm-hmm. So we went back to the ACLU, and we got a local ACLU lawyer named John Bratton, Brattin. I think he's dead now. But he was a guy who'd been active as an ACLU lawyer before there was any ACLU here, so mm-hmm. he was a logical guy. He made only one suggestion about this amicus brief we had prepared, which was about five pages or so. And that was, we were a little too harsh on Hannah and something we said. He said, that you don't need to be harsh, so why do that? So we scratched that out. Mm-hmm. So then, when we get back into court, President Hanna, I always thought this showed that he was a guy who understood leadership, he announced, Mr. Schiff has been kept out of the university long enough, we're readmitting him. And then he assigned somebody from the ad building to take Schiff by the hand and go through the pit. Yes. You know, they don't have that now, I suppose.
Not anymore, right. I worked it and went through it.
It was a gruesome
registration,
process.
Right? Yeah? Registration process.
Registration, yeah. And mm-hmm. it took a couple hours for a student to get through there. And mm-hmm. students didn't like it. And so he was given priority, moved right to the head of the line with his guy from the administration. Mm-hmm. Well, then Schiff, by this time, had decided that economics wasn't a field he wanted to go into. So he abandoned economics and became full-time master's candidate in history. Mm-hmm. The history department, and I don't know who was involved in all this, but he dropped out of history after, I think, a term because the environment there was so hostile to him. These are old guard faculty members mm-hmm. who thought that a student who was leading these protests was somehow inappropriate as a student here or some such thing. But they made his life miserable, so he left, and I don't know where he went. I think he got a PhD in history someplace, but I never had any contact with him.
You didn't after he left campus?
Uh-huh. That's a typical story. You know, sometimes I spend a couple of years helping somebody like that. I invested about a year in his case. Mm-hmm. My wife complained. She said, you spend a lot of time on this case. You ought to be working on a book. I said, look, I can do both. It's not one or the other. Mm-hmm. But the students and the faculty as well, you get involved with it that way, almost never keep in touch with the afterward, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate. I'd like to know. I'd be love to know what happened to Schiff and mm-hmm. where he landed, if mm-hmm. you know.
It sounds like it was a big case at the time.
Oh, and, oh my
whereas
God.
If you talk to people nowadays,
as a matter of fact,
they wouldn't have heard of it.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. But, see, this case was going on during the summer, and some of us wanted to write points of view and letters to the editor denouncing the administration for its mistreatment of Schiff. The editor at that time said, no, we're not going to print any of those letters or points of view because the administrators who are on the receiving end of these criticisms are not on the campus now. They're on vacation somewhere, and so they can't respond. So we won't print any of those.
Mm-hmm. This was in the student paper.
Yeah, the state news.
The state news. Mm-hmm.
That led to a big hassle among the state news staff with, I don't know, half a dozen editors quitting and whatnot. Some of them became quite well known. One of them is a guy named Jim Sterba, who I think he's a vice president of the Wall Street Journal now, something like that. And then they all left, and they founded an underground paper with a not a very creative name. It was just called The Paper.
The Paper.
But that flourished for several years and mm-hmm. Had pretty wide circulation, as I remember it. It should have, because a lot of the people who were putting out The Paper had been editors and reporters and whatnot on the state news, so mm-hmm. they had journalistic experience.
And did the anti-war movement, did they publish, or students that supported that, did they publish in The Paper?
Yeah.
That was a...
Oh, yeah, there was a vehicle for mm-hmm. almost a,
among other things,
a pamphlet for the anti-war movement.
And at the time that this case was going on, Hannah, wasn't he the head of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission?
Yeah, but she led it. Yeah, he was.
Uh-huh. This is right after they'd given their first, or one of their earlier reports.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And this guy Sterba, while on the state news staff, dropped out of school for 6 months or so and went with the Civil Rights Commission down in the South, Mississippi, I think, and reported for the state news from Mississippi or wherever it was mm-hmm. on hearings held by the Civil Rights Commission, and how down there Hannah was accused of being a communist.
But not on campus.
Not here.
That's interesting. How was the Eileen Van Tassel case ultimately?
How was what?
Eileen Van Tassel case.
How was it finally,
it finally resolved?
Well, she got...
She was given that added year.
Two extra years.
Okay.
Two right. separate actions, 1 year at a time.
Right. And this is by the Board of Trustees.
Yeah. Oh. And then she was, if I remember correctly, promoted to associate prof. Received a tenure in mm-hmm. the course of it all. And as I mentioned last time, I think a couple years ago, she suddenly popped up as the chairwoman of the steering committee of the Academic Senate.
Mm-hmm. She'd come a long way. And this was before the grievance
Well, see, I brought her into this this conversation here because the cases that convinced the Board of Trustees that we ought to give have a grievance procedure, we ought to make it a matter of right that an untenured person being denied reappointment could be given the reasons in writing if asked for. The cases that produced that sentiment on the board started with, what did I say, what was the first case there?
Hildebrand?
No, before Orange Horse 3.
Okay.
Orange Horse 3, then Hildebrand, then there was another guy in natural science named Bert Murray,
okay,
who along with Van Tassel were both told you're not going to be reappointed. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, Murray didn't want to contest it.
I see.
But in the course, the first step that I remember now, the first step that I suggested to Van Tassel that she might take would be the same thing I suggested to Hildebrand, and that was file a complaint with the Employment Relations Commission of the State of Michigan, mm-hmm, alleging that she had been denied reappointment because she was engaged in concerted action to bring about changes in her employment conditions. And that's, see, normally concerted action means a labor union, but you don't have to be a labor union. Anybody who engages in that kind of group action is protected by that law. It's sort of the state version of the